Well, we're here. We are indeed. Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland. And the Madison Symphony this coming weekend, it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, May 11th, 12th, and 13th, will be performing an all-Gershwin concert and conducted all of it by Maestro John Demain, who knows more than a little bit about George Gershwin. And I have the pleasure of having him right in the Buck Studio here at the piano with me. We'll hear some of his recordings, too. Welcome.
Thanks, Norman. Glad to be here.
An all Gershwin program that provides nonetheless plenty of variety, and you're going to be, let's see, you have, in addition to excerpts from Porgy and Bess, it'll be the American in Paris, Rhapsody in Blue, and the Cuban Overture. It doesn't get much bigger than that as far as Gershwin's concerned.
Well, in that span of time of roughly about 10, 11 years, we have, with the exception of Concerto in F and the second Rhapsody, I think we have the main pieces from him that have continued in posterity to be just beloved by the world over.
And Gershwin did not, like any other composer, did not just kind of arise sui generis. He obviously was the result of various influences and experiences, even though he was a pretty well-formed musician very early in life, Tin Pan Alley, a song plugger, and that kind of thing. But what kind of influences do you see him soaking up as we get into his early years?
There's no question that he was consumed by music, and he was very aware of everything that was going on. I mean, he heard Wozzeck. You know, he knew
the avant-garde.
Right. He knew Berg, Verez, Schoenberg. He was very aware of what they called the, you know, the six, Debussy and the six in France. Very, very, very up to speed on everything that was going on in the classical world. And he craved to study with a lot of the Europeans, and but his own, and he did a little bit, but his own schedule was so intense that he had to do it more by osmosis and more by absorbing. But there's no question, and he lists his, I think his favorite composers were Bach and Wagner, of all people.
Because... Yeah, you wouldn't have guessed, would you? Just like from the curb.
Right, but you know, I mean, those were just big influences in his life. And then he states that he's very consciously trying to create an American sound. And I think if we were to say who is the first American composer who captures, when you hear his music, it's America, and why is it so? It's Gershwin, and he understood that the inclusion, that America was a democratic country, and that the people, the sound of the people, had to be in the music if it was going to be American. So he uses the composition devices from the European Western, you know, tradition of composition.
The structures
and all of that, you know, and this whole idea of leitmotif, which creates unity and focus to a piece. And, you know, we just go back to Beethoven 5 and we have the quintessential use of the four-note theme. And he incorporates that, but it all is at the base of an American sound. And the American sound comes from jazz and popular music. And he was able to infuse that and create something that was uniquely American. And I think that's why, by the way, people come to all Gershwin concerts in huge numbers, because whether you're a lover of European music or American music, you're in love with this music.
And he came along at such an interesting time for music in America, too. We're talking about the late teens, the early 1920s, when even jazz was something that was changing very quickly.
Right. And I think it was very interesting that because I know that we're going to start the program today with excerpts from Porgy. And it was fascinating to me that as he was developing as a composer, he wanted to write an opera. From the very beginning, he wanted to write an opera on a black theme, or as he would have said, on a Negro theme at that time. And it's because he felt that white culture was too stiff to be able to portray stories that could easily go back and forth between Puccini-like big vocal lines and jazz. But he thought that the black culture was so rich that it would be easy to go back and forth between these forms. And so he became very attracted, almost close to 10 years, at least 8 years before he actually started writing Porgy. I mean, he saw the play on Broadway, fell in love with it, had talked about it for years with Du Bois Hayward that he wanted to make an opera out of it. But he also said that he really didn't want to just plunge into it because he wanted to be able to think a lot about the leitmotifs and the overall structure. And this was something he would be going into for the first time. So then when he really settled down in 1932 to really start to write it, he wrote it in a very intense way. And, you know, and then we had the premiere in 1935 and a lot of course, surrounding that whole event.
Well, of course, he was Gershwin was no stranger to writing songs up to this point. That was nothing new to him, but he was somehow jumping a gap here between all those musicals and Porgy.
Well, he also understood, though, when he wrote Cuban Overture, when he wrote American in Paris, he'd already written Rhapsody in Blue. He wrote all those pieces. I mean, the most recent of those would be Cuban Overture in 1932. So he already was completely familiar with how to structure a classical composition, basically sonata allegro form, you know, with the stave of the development recapitulation, that sort of standard formula for creating a classical piece of music. And he knew how to do that. I think with Porgy, he had to create an additional thing of scene structure and create a unity to this to the scenes. And he studied with Schilling, who was one of the great teachers of composition, and many of the composers at that time studied with, and it brought those elements into focus for him. But there's no question that Porgy was a very, very unique piece.
And it starts with a lullaby, which is very unusual for an opera.
Absolutely. I mean, we meet Bess and I mean, we meet Clara. We meet a lot of different characters. Actually, like Carmen, we don't meet Porgy or Bess until about 20 minutes into the opera. And so the first person we meet is Clara, who has a young baby who's married to Jake. And of course, they're both going to die during the hurricane that's going to happen. And of course, she sings one of the most beloved songs, the summertime idea. But something that somebody once pointed out to me that I thought was interesting is that theme is very spiritual in structure. You know, you have this, well, think sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
That's true.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. And so there was, he spent so much time. I mean, he went to the Holy Roller churches, the Pentecostal churches.
He
spent
immersed
all this
himself.
Time. He and Du Bois Hayward immersed themselves into Charleston and to Cabbage Row, which became Catfish Row,
right.
Kiowa, which became Kittywa, and he really immersed himself in all of that and tried to create those sounds.
Well, now you conducted a major production of Porgy and Bess, I want to say 1976. It was 76, Houston Opera.
Right. We created that production for the bicentennial of the country. Sherwin Goldman, a New York producer, went to the Metropolitan Opera, and they would have had to create a second, an all-black chorus.
Right.
And this was also, by the way, when Gershwin got the idea to write the piece, people said to him, well, you should put it on stage at the Met. And even back then, he said, they're going to do 8 or 10 performances in the fall, and maybe they'll revive it in the spring, and we have to have an all-black chorus, and that won't make sense because the Met has a mixed chorus that is 52 weeks under contract. So he wanted to create a special company, and he thought the best place would be, in a fairly large theater on Broadway. So things hadn't really changed much, I mean, the Met would have had the same issue. Houston Grand Opera could hire people production to production.
Right.
So we said yes. And we embarked on a journey. I know we want to get to some music, so maybe we can talk about some of the challenges that were facing us in 1976, because the piece had become quite controversial in terms of the African Americans' relationship with the piece,
right?
And that's even juxtaposed against what was happening politically in the country. And so the Porgy right now is a wonderfully embraced piece by everyone. But it did go through a rocky period there in the 50s. And our attempt in the 70s was to restore not only the musical brilliance of George Gershwin by really going back to the original and making the recitatives, which were very controversial, making those beautiful and really approaching the piece with as much integrity as possible. And then at the same time, to create an environment on the stage where the African Americans on the stage were proud of what they were doing, because they really felt that their community and their culture was being accurately portrayed. And we did that by drawing on them rather than superimposing on them our idea of what it was.
Trusting
we created
those
an environment for that to come out. And when Todd Duncan, the original Porgy, saw it at Wolf Trap, right before we went to New York, he went on stage opening night and he said, the first words out of his mouth were, "It's so black." And that for us was the moment of triumph, that we had been able to restore this piece. And you know, I mean, Gershwin wrote this piece totally out of love and out of his complete recognition of where his inspiration for his music came from.
And who's singing Clara in this Summertime?
That Betty, oh boy, that's too long ago.
Okay, you can write it down and mail it to us. But in any event, Houston Grand Opera here, John Demain conducting, and this is the opening aria from Porgy and Bess, Summertime. Lane.
Right, Betty Lane.
understated, but it's a lullaby after all.
Yes, I mean, my goodness, have we not heard treatments of Summertime since then? You know, I once heard one by Wynton Marsalis at 2 a.m. in Rio de Janeiro when I was conducting the Earth Summit. It was the most incredible riff on Summertime I'd ever heard in my life. But this sung straight really establishes it as a beautiful aria, beautiful lullaby, and in this instance, although we use the harmonies of this time, it really doesn't suggest jazz at this moment.
No. And we're going through some of the music of George Gershwin, which, as it turns out, yes, it's very American, but like all things American, it has these channels of influence that come from various directions. Do we find those if we look at another song from Porgy and Bess, John, if we look at a this also comes from early in the opera, A Woman is a Sometime Thing?
Well, this is a fun piece because Clara's husband, Jake, takes the baby and says, "I'm going to show you how to put the baby to sleep." And he starts rocking this baby to this tune. You know, there's no way this baby can ever fall asleep.
It's a little robust. You
know. But it also shows the joy in their relationship. And the score, I mean, immediately now you see that we start to swing, for you start a traveling, you know, way up, but up. Start to push the beats, you know. Bah, 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 bah. And he says to us, you know, I mean, Gershwin says, you know, swing style. I mean, this number, there's a boat that's leaving for New York. It ain't necessarily so. I mean, these numbers are definitely meant to be swung, which means that you don't take, for example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. You don't think right. you make triplets out of them. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. You just cheat, which is swing style. And the orchestra understands that, or you tell an orchestra to swing this section, and so that it's authentic in its contrast to the more lyrical parts of the opera.
And this is what it sounds like. A Woman is a Sometime Thing. Listen to your dirty warrior, boy, you start a traveling. first name. Well, it flows very gracefully, this opera, from one piece to the next. But A Woman Is a Sometime Thing, that's another one of those songs, Gershwin songs. I call it a song because that's the way it certainly caught on in American culture and in jazz and various other forms. Well, let's look at another one between now and the bottom of the hour. We'll move right along through Porgy and Bess. And this is actually another one that really took on a life of its own. I Got Plenty of Nothing.
Right. It also was kind of controversial, too, because, I mean, a lot of African-Americans didn't like other African-Americans singing this song at the time. But when you really think about it, I mean, Gershwin intended it to be very tongue-in-cheek, and he really intended it to be a nasty poke at the wealthy white person, you know. But also, this song is about this cripple, Porgy, who thought he was going to spend his life alone, and suddenly this woman's living with him, Bess. And he's really saying, you know, that's the only thing that's important. I don't need anything else. I have this joy in my life, this gift that's been given to me. And that's basically there. And the banjo is, of course, used only in this number. Throughout the piece, we have it reprised, and each time it includes the banjo. But when you see this number in the context of the show, it really is Bess, whose lover killed a man in the first scene, and she sought refuge with Porgy, and the community is beginning to accept her and accept their relationship. And, of course, it's going to have a bad situation further on in the opera. But right now, this is a joyous time.
Oh, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. I got no car, got no mule, got no misery. The folks with plenty of plenty got a lock on that door. Afraid somebody's going to rob him while he's out making more. What for?
I Got Plenty of Nothing with Plenty of Something there in the music of George Gershwin. John Demain conducting, and you have conducted this opera. It's kind of your niche, isn't it? You've conducted this all over the place.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I had no idea that I would be spending so much of my life conducting this piece, but I think it's getting close to 400 performances.
400. So I was going to say you pretty much have it down, and yet it's constantly changing, shifting in some ways.
I think that has a lot to do with who's in the cast, but certainly, I think that we have. I don't have a lot of fresh new ideas about the piece, but I do try to approach it fresh each time, and allow. You know, Gershwin did allow for a certain amount of ad-libbing, and for a certain amount of freedom for the cast, especially in the dramatic situations where they're reacting to the situation, and that he actually wanted that. So, it takes on different angles. Also, you know, I'm still disappointed that because we have, you know, financial restrictions and most of the performances have to stay within a three-hour framework, we very seldom ever get a chance to see the piece that he wrote 4 hours long.
In fact, 4 hours, wow.
It was really very long. And the last recording that came out in Nashville with John Malcheri conducting, he found a piano vocal score from 1935 and said, this is the piece that Gershwin wanted, and he made a big thing about that, and he sort of tried to almost put down some of the stuff that we had done in 1976 to try to find a fresh new angle for a recording release. But the truth of the matter is, Gershwin loved every note of this piece, and he fought with the stage director, Reuben Mamillion, in Boston. They were screaming until the middle of the night, arguing. But it had to come down. And Gershwin was a man of the theater, and he knew it had to come down. So he reluctantly agreed to certain cuts. And you look at them, and the cuts work. Common tone modulations, certain ways we can make cuts. But he never went back and recomposed with those cuts in a way that would make sense, that you would feel these are not cuts and that he really felt this is the piece he wanted. No. This is the piece that he agreed to. And so my recording, and as a few others, have every note ever written, but we don't always get a chance to see it on stage. which may be a good thing, but I think every now and then it would be nice to really see what Gershwin, because his palette was enormous.
In terms of, again, the musical influences,
yes,
and interests,
right,
and things. Right. Does that come out in Bess You Is My Woman? What do you see as the influences?
Well, Bess You Is
that?
My Woman is his Puccini moment.
Uh-huh.
There's no question that's his Puccini moment, because the climax often reminds me of Mimi's climax in La Bohème, the moment when she goes up for that high note. I think I actually could tell you what I mean. This is where that one moment actually has Porgy, and then you have this I's your woman, and then I always like to make a big I's yours. I mean, that's the big, and of course this is his proposal to marriage, you know. I mean, this piece is amazing when you think about Porgy. When he first comes on, he talks about nighttime, daytime, he got to travel that lonesome road.
Oh, yes, there you go. Yeah.
You know, and that's
right
the
out.
Intro to this piece, because that's what he thought his life was going to be. And then he, this lovely cello solo, he then basically, there's three verses, and he basically proposes marriage. And of course, like I said before, Gershwin was so influenced by Carmen that these, underneath all of these songs, you know, are these various dance rhythms, as like the habanera has that recurring thing, or the,
sure,
you know, the seguidilla with and you always have that. So here we have, you know, and over that we have this beautiful lyrical line. So he proposes, the second verse, she sings, Porgy, I's your woman now. And the third one, they sing together, and in a great joyous outpouring. And then you have, I always call these impressionistic, just straight out of, look at those chords. And then she says, oh, my Porgy, oh, my Bessie. These beautiful chords right out of that impressionistic
W.C. Ravel.
That's the Ravel influence. And then you have here, from this minute I'm telling you, I keep this vow, Porgy, Bessie, I's your woman now, we's happy now. I mean, that's their common marriage vow. And that really is, they get married in that sense.
Well, let's hear how it comes out in this performance. Bess, You Is My Woman. Sometimes easy for me, at least, to forget that it's easy for me to forget that Puccini was writing, not finishing, Turandot in 1924, which is the same year as Rhapsody in Blue. You don't usually think of those two in the same hemisphere, do you?
No, absolutely.
But definitely some, as you say, John, some Puccini moments in Bess You Is My Woman. Back with John Demain and the music of George Gershwin, also on those concerts, in addition to those Porgy and Bess excerpts this weekend, American in Paris, from, just a couple of years after Rhapsody in Blue, I think 1926, 28?
28, right? I believe,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it is kind of a program piece in a way. I mean, he is in a way describing somebody walking, an American walking through the streets of Paris, the car horns and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question he's setting out to write a tone poem. And a tone poem really has to have some kind of structure in your mind, whether it's really true or not. I mean, there could be boy meets girl and he loses the girl and goes on. But he wrote in 1934, this very short little thing that I'll read you that Gershwin said about American in Paris. He said, this piece describes an American's visit to the gay and beautiful city of Paris. We see him sauntering down the Champs-Élysées, walking stick in hand, tilted straw hat, drinking in the sights and other things as well. We see the effect of the French wine, which makes him homesick for America. And that's where the blues begins. I mean, the blues begin. He said, and that's where the blue begins. It's both. He finally emerges from his stupor to realize once again that he is in the gay city of Paris, listening to the taxi horns, the noise of the boulevards, and the music of the can-can, and thinking, home is swell, but after all, this is Paris, so let's go.
Wow. So how do we accomplish all that?
Well, he has five different sections that he basically, you know, divides the piece into. And, I mean, the interesting thing was that he uses duple meter to express the French kind of thing. And the sauntering, you know, you can sort of, you know, happy-go-lucky saunter. You just hear that.
Sounds kind of like Satie.
Right. There's no question that that influence is there. And then he... And apparently somebody went into his hotel room and they found, you know, just tons of taxi horns. And he was trying to find them.
Just the right one.
Yeah. Well, he wanted pitched taxi horns. And so, for example, when you first hear the taxi horn, you have this section that goes, the orchestra's playing, but the taxi horn is, so he gets that dissonance. You know, and then
yes.
he keeps going from there with those taxi horns in several different pitches, B, A, D, C. He had quite a few different ones that he wanted. And then he has a section where...
But you have to get all these taxi horns for the orchestra?
Sure. Well, I think that's part of the...
They're just out there.
Their battery now, you know, uh-huh. to play this piece. You have
these horns.
Yep. Mm-hmm. We're going to show up tonight for the first rehearsal, and they'll just be squawking away, you know, quack, 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 quack. And but he really wanted to, and there was, you know, he passes a church, and then he goes into the bar. And that's a little slow section, the beautiful part that I think it goes like this. Let's check it. You have this, now that all sounds very smooth, but we really have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, and so, and then the tune going with it, his wistful thing going. So, and that's his sort of starting to, you know, cry in his cups. but basically we're constantly in variations of 2/4 time. But when he's really homesick for America and that sort of takes over, the music changes to 4/4 time. And we get this one. And against that, that trumpet plays bum bum bum. And of course,
yes,
it's the blues note.
Of course,
you know,
of course,
always
yes.
The blues note. And so America's the blues, and it's in 4/4 time. And of course, now there's another little secret, sort of underneath all of this. When he has this modulate over here to B flat, listen to the bass line once. And this is, it's Bach.
Oh,
that's the air in the G string, you know, boom, boom, boom. Because he just was enamored with Bach. And so that's filtered in there. And of course, we put the two ideas together, and he says, come, you know, it's in Paris, so, you know, get over it, and have fun. And so at the end, you have just this grand statement of the blues, but And he takes, this is actually, this had been, that had been fast, but part of the Paris theme, and he goes, and then he hits that last chord, and he blueses it, right? He goes, and those two worlds have, you know, come together at the very end. But so that's, but brilliant piece of orchestration, using saxophones, big horn and brass section, and of course, you know, as was true of that turn of the century, is the inclusion of a lot more interesting.
Yes, the instruments of the orchestra really
percussion
expanded.
Instruments, and so the idea of putting a taxi horn in, which gives it so much personality and character, probably wouldn't have happened in the 19th century the same way.
Now, there's a bit of a controversy about the Rhapsody in Blue. If you listen to the Paul Whiteman, I'm going to say 1924 recording, it's not surprisingly more frenetic than the versions that you hear as the years go by that get slower and bigger.
Well, yes, I think you're right. And there's a couple things that Gershwin, you know, Bernstein, when he recorded, he started making his own jazz on top of jazz. So I remember this section here. Lenny would go.
Yes.
But Lenny was always trying to improve other composers' pieces. sometimes well, sometimes not very well. Still, he was a great genius. And actually, when Lenny came to see My Porgy and Bess, I was so amazed because he came backstage. He was going to record it, and then it fell through. But he had never, ever performed it. And he started singing to me the most obscure sections that we had cut. And I thought, my goodness, how well this man knew this piece and was influenced by Gershwin. I mean, I think Gershwin set the stage for everybody. I mean, after Gershwin came Blitzstein, who was Lenny's teacher. And Blitzstein gave us Cradle Will Rock and the opera sure. Regina based on the Little Foxes. And then Lenny, of course, gave us West Side and Candide and of course, his classical compositions. And I think he saw himself in Gershwin's mold, and so did Sondheim. I mean, Sondheim had a huge affection for Porgy and Bess, for example, as far as his theater writers are concerned. But getting back to the distortions of the second theme, you know, in the first measure of Rhapsody in Blue, first eight measures, you get not only this, you know, all this, you get all that,
yes.
That little theme, this thing. And then when he goes, I mean, you know, that then, I mean, it just immediately relates to that. And then right away in the ninth measure you get. So those are the basic materials that make up the whole piece, except we have a second theme with using blues, seventh. That second theme. And then the next really significant moment is the Adantino, where the controversy starts. It is written Adantino moderato with expression. And you have this. Right. Now, right at this point, you have that
right.
figure, right?
Which is where Whiteman takes off.
So if I were to do this, and there's no indication of any change in tempo. If I were to do this, this would sound like this. One, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one. That would be what's written. So there's two things I think one has to do. The second time he writes it, he does say poco rubato. There's two things that has to happen. I think you have to look at the Adantino. One, two, three, four, two, three, four. Then you're there. One, two, three. Then you can move it a little bit. And so I think it's that distortion that has to be restored, that we don't take the two extremes, because
right.
I don't think that's what Gershwin
Smooth
intended.
Smooth it out as he intended.
And then, of course, that great ending when he puts it all together and you have those big cards. you know,
and the orchestra comes in, blasts it. Yeah.
By the way, the new Porgy and Bess on Broadway has an on track to the second act based on "Bess You Is My Woman," where the piano plays the "Bess You Is My Woman Now," and he makes it. Sound just like,
yeah, just like Rhapsody in Blue.
But that was not Gershwin. That was the current arranger.
We have just a couple of minutes to get to the last piece on the program we haven't talked about. That's the Cuban Overture, which was the result, wasn't it, of Gershwin doing a little tourism down that way?
Yeah, absolutely. He went to Havana and he hit the clubs at night and heard those salsa rhythms and brought back the gourd and the maraca and these percussion instruments that he associated, that he heard. And then he decided to write an overture using all of that. And he gave us a fantastic piece that really captures the whole sound of what he heard.
Can you give us a dance rhythm or two from that?
Yes, I think that what's interesting is the very first beats that he sets up when he has us do and he does 1 2 3 4 one two be a walk be and then you know, in a way, and away he goes, but and he has these ideas that and then that translates over to the trumpet doing so 1 minute it's a melody, another minute it's a bass.
Very 30s, very Cuban.
Very Cuban. And long intros of rhythm before the melody comes in, because he would hear them on stage, you know, taking their time just setting this rhythm, getting people ready for it over and over again, and then all of a sudden it would start. And so he captured that. And then, as I said, these those percussion instruments being there all the time.
It's all there. Well, that's all the time we have for this hour of the midday, but we packed in as much as we could. John Demain, he's going to be conducting the Madison Symphony in these upcoming performances this weekend, Friday night, 7:30, Saturday night, 8 o'clock, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30 in the Overture Center for the Arts in Madison, an all Gershwin concert from a guy who certainly knows his Gershwin. 400 performances of Porgy and Bess alone. Wow. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's been a great pleasure.